North Carolina is among the top 10 states in the country with the highest number of reported human trafficking cases. Experts say contributing factors include the state's strategic location along the East Coast, the number of major interstates that cross through the state, and the state's large population of agricultural workers. In the past few years, state government and law enforcement agencies have tried to do something about it. Later, we will talk with legal experts and law enforcement officials about their attempts to end this. But first, we're joined by Karen Arias. She's an advocate and interviewer with the 30th Judicial District Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Alliance. And in that role, she leads a rapid response team for human trafficking survivors in six counties in western North Carolina and joins me now from partner station WCQS in Asheville. Karen, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
Can you start off by telling us exactly what we mean when we say human trafficking?
Well, let me just read the definition that we used when we training law enforcement and service providers. Human trafficking includes all acts involved in the recruitment, abduction, transport, harboring, transfer, sale or receipt of persons for the purpose of subjection to involuntary servitude, peonage, debt bondage, slavery, or exploitation.
How would this be different from, say, if we're talking about procuring or pimping prostitutes? Do you make a distinction?
No, because we tend to think that we are moving people from one place to the locations, from one place to the other. The procuring is not the trafficking itself. It's the sale, is the benefit from the trafficker to earn money or earn goods, any exchange for either the labor or the sex act.
And this is a broad term. It encompasses more than sex trafficking, right? We're talking about labor. You can be international, be brought from abroad or locally. Give us a sense of the scope of what we're talking about when we talk about trafficking.
Sure. There are several things that we can look at. We have labor trafficking, which is where we are forcing someone to work, whether it be at a farm or a restaurant, at home as a nanny, where there is no exchange of there's no wages. Someone is being kept, someone being coerced in to do this job. There's the bonded labor where, for example, we bring someone to work at a farm, and this person might very well be someone who's documented with a work permit, and then the trafficker takes those paperwork and then starts charging for food, room and board, and the person never pays off the debt, so they continues to work to pay off a debt that just keeps getting higher. The forced labor, obviously, that is when we use force and threats to keep someone at bay, whether that would be we'll harm a family member, we'll go home back to your home country, or just basically, power and control and abuse, and the person is afraid to report. We have child labor. This is where we also have the children that might come with the families that come to work at our camps, and they're also put to work. They suffer from substantial health problems, and no one of that is reported. Obviously, the internal domestic sex labor that we have in the country, where we have a lot of our youth, whether it's that young women and young men who are being sold for sex.
I'm talking with Karen Arias, who leads a rapid response team for human trafficking survivors in six counties in western North Carolina. She's part of our conversation on human trafficking in North Carolina today, and that conversation will continue on the State of Things. From North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. We're talking today about human trafficking in the state. North Carolina ranks in the top 10 states in the nation for reported human trafficking cases. I've been talking with Karen Arias, who leads a rapid response team for human trafficking survivors in six counties in western North Carolina. Karen, can you give us a sense of the numbers here in North Carolina? I know these numbers are difficult to track, but maybe you can give us a sense of what we're talking about in North Carolina.
Sure. First, let me say that the numbers are obviously underreported because a lot of victims don't self-identify as victims of trafficking. And then sometimes they're not necessarily reported as such, whether it's by law enforcement when we're prosecuting them. But if you go to Polaris Project or the National Human Trafficking Resource Center hotline, you can actually look up some of the most recent numbers as far as the state of North Carolina. In 2016, so far, we had 13,454 calls this year. That will be whether it's somebody reporting suspicion, somebody making a report that they a victim has been found or that the response team needs to be enacted. Someone who might have been also documented as such because we're going through a victim agency and recognize that this is a victim of human trafficking. We had so far 3,646 human trafficking cases reported in North Carolina as far as this year. Now, in 2015, according to the report, we had sex trafficking cases, 36 of them, labor trafficking, 11, trafficking, the type that was not necessarily specified, that was 5, 52 human trafficking cases reported in the state of North Carolina.
Well, and you talked about the breadth of and the scope of this problem, but I wonder if you can paint a picture for us of any common characteristics of survivors.
Obviously, and I would think in any power and control situation to where the survivor is not able to speak for herself or himself, fear to, you know, sometimes is in the demeanor. If someone comes through the health department or the ER and they are with someone who obviously speaks for them and controls everything that says and does not allow them to be by themselves. It would be one of the characteristics is that isolation from the public or the ability to be able to communicate with someone.
We're talking today about sex trafficking in the state of North Carolina. I'm talking now with Karen Arias, who's an advocate and interviewer in the 30th Judicial District Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Alliance. Karen, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Well, one measure in the state of North Carolina that has changed about sex trafficking in 2013 was a law that governs sex trafficking and how it's prosecuted. Attorney Lindsay Roberson drafted that legislation, and I spoke with her earlier, and I asked her how she ended up writing the changes to the state's approach to trafficking and prosecution.
Well, I moved back to North Carolina from New York, where I had been a private attorney in 2012 and joined the district attorney's office in Wilmington, North Carolina. And as a new prosecutor, very interested in this topic of human trafficking and commercial exploitation, started looking at the laws in North Carolina and realizing that we had some very archaic laws. Our prostitution laws had not been amended since 1918. And our human trafficking laws, which had been in effect since 2006, were not being used at all across the state. And so I realized we have a problem both with victim identification and also with the utilization of those laws and the laws themselves. So I just really started talking to people, other advocates, legislators, what would it take to bring this law current and make it more accessible and usable for our law enforcement to help identify victims and prosecute offenders.
Well, and then what would that mean? What were some of the shortcomings in the laws as they existed?
Sure. So prior to 2013 in North Carolina, it was a misdemeanor to pimp out a human being or to sell them for sex. And that's a problem for many reasons, but not the least of which it doesn't encourage law enforcement to investigate that crime because the crime of prostitution itself is the same level offense. So they stop at the prostitute and they don't move to try to find or identify who is the pimp who is benefiting commercially from the situation. So that was one problem. Additionally, even though trafficking a human was a felony, it was a very low level offense. And so trying to get victims to cooperate in situations where they're very scared of the offender, of their trafficker, is very hard when you cannot help or promise them to put their trafficker in prison for any extended period of time. So that was a problem as well. Also in North Carolina, we were prosecuting juveniles for prostitution. 16 and 17-year-olds were going to jail for prostitution instead of being recognized as victims.
So, and when you say that it was a crime and it was only a misdemeanor at the time for pimping out another human being, how do you distinguish that, or do you, from trafficking?
That's a really good question. So by definition under the law, if I'm going to traffic an adult, I'm going to have to prove as a prosecutor that I did that through coercion or deception under North Carolina law, that I'm profiting from the sale of your being and that I'm using coercion and deception in order to keep you under my control. But for pimping, I don't have to prove those additional elements of coercion or deception. I just have to prove that I'm profiting from the sale of illegal contraband, which makes sense because selling any amount of drug in North Carolina was a felony. So it seems to follow, it should make sense that it would be a felony to sell right. a person.
So what changed in the law when you got at it and began to promote these changes?
Yeah, three main things took effect when Safe Harbor came into effect in October of 2013. One is that we recognize anyone under the age of 18 who is sold or being sold for commercial sex is a victim, not an offender, and they're no longer eligible for prosecution. Second, we raised the level of offense for pimping to a felony and also increased the level of felony for trafficking. And also traffickers who are convicted will have to register on the sex offender registry list in North Carolina. And then the last thing that the law really does is it tries to protect victims, adult and minors, by giving them an opportunity. If an adult is charged with a crime of prostitution and it's a first offense, giving them an opportunity for a deferred prosecution to get that off their record. If they've previously been convicted and shouldn't have been convicted because they were a victim or they were a minor, they now have remedies for expunction and under our state law.
Is that only for prostitution or any crimes they might have committed while they were in the hands of a trafficker?
So currently, as the law is written, it only applies to the prostitution offense. There are other expunction provisions that apply to all sorts of offenses in other parts of the statutes.
So where does North Carolina fit nationwide in this picture of how it handles sex trafficking and prostitution?
Well, North Carolina, something a lot of people don't realize is that we do have a large population of victims living among us. We're in the Southeast, where the FBI estimates that a quarter of all victims end up because of our sort of location geographically. We're between huge hubs like Atlanta, Charlotte, D.C. We sort of sit in that triangulated area. And that's one of the reasons we really needed to pay attention to what our laws are doing and how we're identifying victims. So we became the 13th state to pass Safe Harbor. So that was great for our state. I think where we really need to head is giving resources, both legislatively and giving resources to victim service providers to actually assist the women, girls, and boys that are coming out of trafficking situations, because one of the things we were unable to do with Safe Harbor was garner any financial support from the legislation.
What about law enforcement? I mean, clearly by changing the incentives, by making trafficking a felony or pimping a felony along with trafficking, that changes incentives. So that's going to have an impact on enforcement. Were there any other changes with regard to enforcement?
So in 2012, before the 2013 law took effect, it actually became mandatory for all basic law enforcement training to include a four-hour block for human trafficking for all new officers, which was great, step in the right direction. The problem with that is some of the old guard law enforcement that's been in 15, 20 years, they haven't had that training. And so there's some tension there in the way that those officers will approach cases. So we've really been moving to make that law enforcement training mandatory for all levels of law enforcement, because we really, really see a huge difference in victim identification and crime identification when law enforcement has been able to attend those kinds of training.
You know, it's really interesting when you talk about the resources not being there to help victims of these crimes. Obviously, people in the business of procuring humans for human trafficking know very well where to hang out, bus stations. They know the profile. They know who they're looking for, and they can talk people into becoming part of this web. It's amazing to me, I guess, that we don't have the resources to do the same thing and bring them to Safe Harbor, to make those same recognitions and say, this is a child or this is a young person who is really in trouble. We should do something about this before the other guys get to them.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, and that's a really good point, too. People often ask, you know, what can I do? I'm not a prosecutor. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not law enforcement. How can I help with this issue? And the thing is, it's not just about when after the child has been exploited. It's before exploitation, recognizing what are those risks, what are the red flags, what are the warning signs that we should be looking for as school teachers, as nurses, as parents. And so I do a lot of talking in the community about raising that level of awareness on a community level as well, so that we're not just talking about rehabilitation and restoration after exploitation, but that we're also talking about prevention.
So what are the biggest legal obstacles that still remain to prevent human trafficking today?
I think that where we ended up with Safe Harbor and our felony levels of prosecution for trafficking and pimping, I would like to see those increased even further. I'd like to see them get a little bit closer to the sorts of penalties that we see on the federal side, so that all of these cases don't necessarily have to go into federal prosecution, that on the state level we have the sort of teeth that we need in the legislation to go after these traffickers. But also we need the resources. We need, you know, local law enforcement to be willing to recognize this offense and put their experienced investigators in positions and give them the ability to actually investigate these cases.
Lindsay, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Lindsay Roberson is a Wilmington-based attorney at McGuire Woods, and she spoke about the need for engagement by law enforcement officials to identify and prosecute human traffickers. My next guest does just that. Major Rick Hoffman has worked for the Raleigh Police Department for more than two decades. 4 years ago, he was asked to lead the charge in developing a unit focused on human trafficking cases. Major Hoffman, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me more about how this unit came to be.
Well, we recognized Captain Kerrigan actually was the first person within our department to recognize that our response was ineffective. He was part of the North Carolina Coalition Against Human Trafficking and actually worked very closely with Lindsay Robson in that law. We recognize that we assign work by crime classification. So if you are investigating a robbery, it goes to your robbery unit. If you're investigating a drug offense, it goes to your drug offense unit. But human trafficking is unique in that it's multifaceted. So when you look at human trafficking, you're looking at the intersection of drugs, money, sex crimes, weapon crimes. And they don't self-report. So you might have a victim that is recognized as a victim of a sex crime, but nobody takes it a step further to investigate as human trafficking potentially. Or you may have someone that investigates a heroin offense, but doesn't realize that the heroin addict is supporting her addiction and being exploited by a pimp. And so we started by coordinating our cases, and then we started doing our proactive efforts because I asked, how many cases do we have? Zero. Okay, we don't have a problem, right? Well, we do have a problem. It just wasn't the problem I thought we had. We don't identify cases because we don't look for them. So some of the steps that we took, we started looking for any robbery that happened at a hotel reported by a female. We looked for new ways to basically search through our own data by using keywords. We recognize that some keywords are very associated to human trafficking. We made a list and we run automatic scripts. We immediately looked at all of our runaways. Any person that's run away more than twice, any person that's been a runaway that is a minor that has been gone more than 2 months. And we started identifying and seeing that we had missed cases. Then we started to look at all of the ways that you could advertise. So when we looked at this law, we look at what the verbs are. You have to transport. You have to harbor. You have to recruit. How do they do that? What tools do they use? Why can't we look at it the same way? And we began to identify cases very quickly, and we got out in the community, met many of the victim service providers, many of the other folks already working this arena, introduced ourselves, and offered our assistance. And what we found was we had plenty of work to do.
Well, so this is a whole different approach to investigating because you have to look at it, again, in the way the tentacles reach into many different aspects of crime. And I understand it's in some ways the reverse of sort of broken window policing in that you have to kind of work from you may have to let the smaller crimes go to find your way up the web, the ladder.
You do. Very often we look at, say, a drug offense as a drug offense, and we don't look at causation, and we don't go further. So when I think about human trafficking, I think about a criminal enterprise. The person that we have contacted that may have committed a minor offense could very well be the victim of a much larger crime, and our time is much better spent being effective at investigating that crime so that other people are not victimized as opposed to just simply looking at this as writing a citation.
Now, let me ask you, because this can be a difficult culture change in a police department. Was it? You're talking about maybe letting people go. This is a bust. I can make it. It goes on my record, and it's part of my advancement. Record. It's easier than waiting for the big guy, which could take 3 years.
I didn't have difficulties because I looked at it as a challenge. Very often when we have to take something, it's the way it's presented to people. And I presented it as, I'm going to go pick a fight. I'm going to create a big problem, and then we're going to solve it together. We're going to have a good time. So when these officers are engaged and they have to learn new tools such as, you know, social media analytics, going to hotels and engaging folks at the hotels, and they realize there is a lot of enforcement, and when we arrest a person and charge them federally that they're getting a 15-year sentence, they realize why we do it this way, and they buy in. And to bridge the gap between the old guys and the new guys, when we do operations, I reach out for people in patrol and include them in my operations to get that buy-in so that they can see and understand the back end. So when they're out there on the streets, they understand why they need to focus on this on the front end.
And I also understand that you're acting proactively rather than reactively. In other words, looking for signs of victims. Is that right?
It is. We look at all the places that we know and suspect that there's commercial sex trade advertising. And we attempt very hard to identify anybody that's on those sites in order to locate minors. And very frequently we find minors and we have to call other cities because they're no longer in our city after we get court orders to figure out where they're at and say, hey, you've got a 16-year-old at this hotel at this street. Could you go pick them up? And we've been successfully able in the last 3 years to identify almost 1,000 separate individuals that have been posted for sexual advertisements within our jurisdiction.
And there are a number of cases now closely tied to the state's heroin epidemic. Am I right about that?
It is. When I'm asked what the main driver is, one of the things that I don't often hear about, and today I was supposed to be at a heroin summit, is opiate addiction. So what happens to a young woman who is at a high school, begins to abuse prescription medication, then later has to turn for affordability reasons to heroin? Where do you get your heroin from? A drug dealer. Then what do you do when you don't have money? What do you have to offer? You have your body to offer. Then what happens when that drug dealer realizes that if I take this person and allow another person to have sex with them for money, I don't have to buy drugs. I don't have to carry drugs, and I don't have to sell drugs. I can do all that to you, and they begin to exploit them.
What are the red flags? You talked about working in the community, working with hotels and others that that have vulnerable populations moving through. What are the signs? What are we looking for?
What I look for in any hotel is, are you renting daily or are you renting weekly? Does the school bus stop at your hotel? That's no longer a hotel. That is a community, and it's a very vulnerable community. And I like to start with hotels. I frequently start with the people that clean the hotels. Frankly, I ask, do you have people that don't request room service, but they always want their towels changed? You know, and I find that it is not difficult for people to tell you, this person over here is engaged in prostitution. There's robberies. When you see people loitering outside, you can talk to them. They don't know who to ask. They don't know who to tell. So if you take the first step and you go there and ask them, what do you see around here that I could help you with? They will usually engage you.
Are you finding it difficult, or that victims find it difficult to encounter or engage police to self-report?
They do. They have a lot of obstacles. First of all, victims don't know human trafficking. They don't define themselves as a human trafficking victim. They define themselves as a robbery victim. You know, they sometimes they don't see themselves as a victim. They see themselves as having made poor choices, and this is what I get for those choices. They don't see themselves as being exploited. You know, there are lots of different types of pimps. I call them the beasts. You got the boyfriend, you've got the brute, you've got the businessman, and you got the bottom. The first three are how they recruit you. Do they recruit you through violence? That's the brute. Do they recruit you by telling you that they can make your life easy because they're 18 and they can rent your room and they can rent your hotel? Or, you know, are they the boyfriend? I'm in love with you. This is just for a short period of time. I can help you. It's going to get so much better. And that's what I look for.
Major Rick Hoffman has been with the Raleigh Police Department for more than 20 years. He's helped develop a program to respond specifically to human trafficking incidents. Major Hoffman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Most welcome.
Our conversation about human trafficking and the legal recourse for human trafficking survivors continues on the State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. We're talking about human trafficking this hour in North Carolina. The state ranks in the top 10 nationally for trafficking cases, due in large part to a population of agricultural workers. The majority of civil cases involving human trafficking in this state are related to labor. And I'm joined now by a lawyer who works closely with these cases. Caitlin Ryland is the supervising attorney, or a supervising attorney, I should say, with Farm Worker Unit at Legal Aid North Carolina. Caitlin, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about, how does a case come across your desk and what does it look like?
We may get a referral from the National Human Trafficking Hotline operated by the Polaris Project. It's a wonderful resource, and it's a 24-hour hotline, 7 days a week, and they can take calls from victims, community members, even law enforcement looking to connect with other law enforcement that are trained in assisting trafficking victims. We also get calls from workers who know that about our office and want to report a tip or their own circumstances or other advocates that are working in the community.
Are there particular industries where this is more prevalent?
Trafficking is typically prevalent where you've got you might not need as much capital to run the business, but really a labor intensive business. So trafficking has been identified in hair salons, in restaurants, in landscaping and construction work, and then also in migrant farm work.
And so what typically, what does this case involve? Is this somebody who is kidnapped, brought to a place and forced to work? Or who are we talking about?
Well, we don't have that element of movement that is required. Sometimes it can be part of the trafficking scheme when you take someone out of a known community and they're a stranger in a foreign place. We often see someone might be migrating to a community or offered a false promise of opportunity. Come to North Carolina, you could make X amount per day, and there's going to be housing for you, and you just need to pay these costs in order to get this opportunity. And they may rely on those promises, and when they arrive, if their employer didn't comply with those promises, then
so how does it become a trafficking, a civil case, for instance? What does mm-hmm. that mean, and how is that individual? What is it about their situation? Okay, they were been lied to, they got this job, but somehow they can't leave. And so, what's the thing that keeps them there, which I suspect is the part that's illegal? And how does the civil law or civil remedy? How is that distinguished from criminal?
A trafficking victim is typically controlled by force, fraud, or coercion unless they're a minor and they're forced to commit a commercial sex act. That might be physical force, that kidnapping scenario that you might see in the movies. It might be through fraudulent promises, deception. And it also may be through non-physical means of coercion, psychological coercion. So promises, exploitation of debts, threats of shame, befalling a family member. It is really difficult to build rapport with victims,
why is it?
Educate them about the law.
Why is it difficult?
Well, they're in that trafficking situation, yeah. Or if they've just been liberated from that trafficking situation, oftentimes everything that made them vulnerable to that trafficker still exists. So they still may be a stranger in a foreign place, and it's hard to access services. There still may be that threat of harm against their family members, fear, mistrust of law enforcement, local or federal.
So you're working with civil cases. What relationship mm-hmm. do you have with the criminal side?
At Legal Aid, provide a couple different types of civil relief. One of those types would be assisting victims with applying for immigration relief if they're a foreign-born victim and they meet the criteria. And so as part of that process, we would explain to them that eligibility for that remedy and assist them to report to law enforcement and help them connect with that process. It can be a long process.
Is it different if the victim is a child or an adult? And then I'll ask you another question, whether or not they're a United States resident or a citizen or a foreign national?
So if they're applying for immigration, these types of immigration relief that are available to victims of trafficking, like a continuous presence, which would be applied for by the law enforcement agency, or a T or U visa, if you're a minor victim, you don't have to testify.
But that's an interesting protection there. Mm-hmm. So the promise, because I would suspect that one of the threats that's held over them by the trafficker is that I'm talking about undocumented immigrants, for mm-hmm. instance, is that you'll be sent back, you'll be arrested. Well, if I can get this visa because I've been identified as a victim, that relieves some of that threat, some of the danger.
Yes. I mean, it's always not a guaranteed outcome. So I think we are very careful to counsel victims that may be eligible for this relief, that they might be eligible for this and there is help, and that we're working with law enforcement that has training working with victims and wants to hear their story and is not interested in deporting them right away.
There's a new project called the Second Chance Project. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's a division of Legal Aid of North Carolina that assists with that remedy that Lindsay Roberson spoke of earlier, that post-conviction relief that's available to certain victims that have criminal charges related to the trafficking.
Well, I want to ask someone else to join our conversation now, and that is Mamie Adams. She's the coordinator of a new project in Western North Carolina that tries to end trafficking by coordinating a range of support services for survivors. The project is called Of Our Voice. It's a nonprofit crisis and intervention agency, and Mamie joins us from partner station WCQS. Mamie, welcome to the State of Things.
Hello, thank you.
There's some overlap between sexual assault, domestic violence, and human trafficking, I understand. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. So a lot of times people want to talk about sex trafficking. They say, how can modern-day slavery be happening? And they don't want to talk about rape. They don't want to talk about how women's bodies are not their own. They don't want to talk about how homophobia and transphobia, what that looks like in real time for young youth, especially in our state, who run away and then are approached by a trafficker within 48 hours of running away. So it's really interesting because a lot of these conversations about trafficking, rape will not come up even one time. Mm. When we talk about sex trafficking, we have to talk about someone's right to their own body, especially around sexual violence. Domestic violence also plays a part in that a lot of times people are sex trafficked by an intimate partner. So that person presents as a boyfriend, or it could be a husband. And so a lot of times, like we're talking about how people are misidentified as a trafficking survivor, a lot of times people are identified as it's a domestic violence situation. So, and that's an issue sometimes for law enforcement. They'll come in and they'll say, oh, no, this is just a domestic violence situation. Or even for agencies, they'll treat a person as if they've only been sexually assaulted or in a DV situation instead of being trafficked.
It's interesting. So in some ways, some of the enlightened police practices that were outlined by Raleigh
yes.
Police Major Rick Hoffman would go
exactly.
a long way. You mentioned homophobia,
yes.
too. What's the relationship between homophobia and trafficking?
Well, so like I was saying about the runaway teens, so one in three runaway teens will be lured by a trafficker within 48 hours of running away. Nationally, the statistic is that 40% of runaway teens are LGBTQ. And so I don't have stats for our state, but anytime that the government of a state has laws that are particularly homophobic or transphobic, that trickles down. That trickles down and empowers parents to not treat their child who's LGBTQ as a person and not. And so that encourages when a young person feels safer on the streets than
right.
at home, that contributes towards trafficking.
Because it contributes, obviously, that high percentage of LGBTQ youth mm-hmm. who are runaways suggests
yes.
that there's something unsafe about their home or school environment. In other words, homophobia may be one of the things that made them feel vulnerable at home and run away in the first place. Now they're even more vulnerable on the street.
Absolutely. And laws like HB2 that make it difficult for LGBTQ people, especially trans folks, to get a job and then to keep a job, that forces people into financial destitution, which we all can identify that people who are the most vulnerable in our societies are the people who are getting trafficked, the people who are the most invisible. I think in our state. Yes?
Can you tell us a bit about recidivism among human trafficking survivors?
Absolutely. So when agencies see a survivor of trafficking, we try to immediately put them well and above the situation they were in before they got trafficked, which was financial destitution. That is incredibly hard. We cannot match the kind of false promises that traffickers give. So I think Caitlin was just mentioning about that false promise of, I'm going to give you shelter, I'm going to give you food, I can take care of you, you can make thousands of dollars. Right, we can't match that because we're not going to give false promise. And how that looks now is we're going to say, Maybe I can get you into a shelter tonight. I'm working really hard and I'm trying to get you into a shelter tonight, but I can't promise you that. And so that's a big issue for us as agencies, is no matter how hard we work and how kind we are and how much we really want to help a survivor, it is incredibly difficult because traffickers outfund us by millions of dollars.
Well, I mean, it's not on nonprofits to make that promise. Imagine living in an economy that can't promise food and shelter to its citizens.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly.
Talk a bit about the racial background of trafficking survivors.
And so the U.S. Department of Justice for, I can speak of sex trafficking, and then it looks different for labor trafficking. So for sex trafficking, it's 40% black, 24% Hispanic, and 26% white. For labor trafficking, Hispanic, that percentage is a lot higher. And so that's another misconception. A lot of people think that trafficked people are only foreign-born, and they don't realize how many U.S. citizens are being trafficked.
Does that tell us about does that paint a picture or give us a better idea about the connection between trafficking and some of these larger systems and how they're networked, how these networks look?
Absolutely. The networks of traffickers?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. So traffickers prey on people who are the most vulnerable. So racially speaking, who is more vulnerable? Not white people as much as Hispanics and blacks. And so another thing to look at is how do traffickers use fear of law enforcement against victims? And we have people like Rick who are working tirelessly to help that go away so that victims can trust police officers. And right now, how it looks is that people, if a victim of trafficking knew that they could go up, they could call 911 and say, I am being trafficked, and then they would be believed and they would be helped right away, or go up to a police officer and say that. And right now it doesn't look that way because they're scared. Black people are scared to go up to a police officer. Undocumented people are scared to go up to a police officer. And so there are so many people who are committed in law enforcement to change that. And I'm really proud of the law enforcement that I'm working with here in Asheville.
You know, I want you to go back to something you said earlier, the trafficking community. You use the word modern source. Often we hear the term modern slavery, and you made reference to this earlier, the way this becomes kind of a touchy question or touchy issue, but it also points to some of the difficulty in understanding this issue. Tell us more about that.
Absolutely. Well, I think that slavery, we like to think of slavery as in the past, and we like to think, well, if I lived back then, I would have been a part of the Underground Railroad, and I would have definitely given Harriet Tubman $20. And we like to think, we get to look back and think, oh wow, I would have been really active in ending slavery back in the day. And so that, I think calling it slavery now, it makes people feel uncomfortable because they don't know how to act. They don't know what to do.
What do you do in terms of the benefits that you can offer survivors and some of the ways in which you can help them recover? What are some of those processes and some of the programs that you have in place?
So we just we just created the West NC Working to End Sex Trafficking in North Carolina. We just started that 5 weeks ago. So what we're doing is we're trying to really build services that are really comprehensive, that take care of the many, many issues that a survivor of trafficking would have. Even something seemingly so little as being tattooed by a trafficker, connecting them with a local tattoo artist who is then supported by Survivors, Inc., a nonprofit in Ohio that helps women get their tattoos by traffickers and pimps covered with a new tattoo of their choosing. So looking at all of the different ways that a person feels like their body is not worthwhile and their body is not their own, how do we change that completely?
Is there any need? I mean, I'm thinking, too, about the need for shelter. Once somebody's been identified, they feel,
absolutely,
I would think, terribly frightened about the possibility. This is a big business you're interfering with, and when you do that, that doesn't go down lightly. So what do you do?
Absolutely.
I mean, can you put somebody in a shelter? Does there have to be special housing for people who need to be protected?
Well, luckily we have, especially here in Asheville, we have an amazing DV shelter, HelpMate. Also in the surrounding counties, we have amazing shelters that already work to help protect women who are being sought after. Sometimes we do have to bring in the FBI if it's an organized trafficked crime group. It is incredibly dangerous, and because we took somebody's quote-unquote cash cow, and now they're a talking head. And we're talking about toughening laws against traffickers. I mean, if somebody is out there who could put someone away for life, that is a huge, they're in danger.
We talked with Lindsay Robeson earlier about some of the changes that have been made. What new changes, what other changes maybe do you think need to be made?
Changes
in the law.
You know, that's not my area of expertise. I'm so glad that there are people like Lisa who are doing this kind of work, because that is a whole other ball game. My focus is.
Well, let me ask Caitlin Ryland here. Mm-hmm. She's a supervising attorney at Legal Aid. Anything that would help you in changes in the law?
Well, I work for a federally funded organization that can't endorse or suggest any changes in the law, but there are some really great folks out there that are doing that work. The Polaris Project is at the forefront of that type of work here in the United States.
Well, I want to thank you both for being on the program. Caitlin Ryland is a supervising attorney with the Farmwork Unit at Legal Aid North Carolina, and Mamie Adams is the coordinator of a new initiative working to end sex trafficking in North Carolina, a part of Our Voice, a nonprofit crisis and intervention agency. She joined me from partner station WCQS in Asheville. Mamie, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Caitlin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Our thanks to Carolina Public Press for their help in putting together this program. You can hear more from our guests in the public conversation about human trafficking hosted by the Carolina Public Press. The event takes place tomorrow at Lenore Ryan University Center for Graduate Studies in Asheville, and you can find out the details at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Ormond. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.